Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the right foundation for a lifetime of mental health? Many parents now understand that the first 3 years of life are critical to their children's physical health and intellectual development. But those same years also include key milestones in children's sense of themselves, of their value to the people around them, and of their place in the world at large. So what does it take to give babies what they need to feel secure, confident, and happy later on? Dr. T. Barry Brazelton is professor emeritus of Harvard Medical School and founder of the Brazelton Touchpoint Center at Children's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Joshua Sparrow is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard and director of special initiatives at the Brazelton Touchpoint Center. They worked together on the most recent editions of the books Touchpoints, Birth to Three, and Touchpoints, Three to Six, and they are in Dallas for this weekend's conference of the Texas Association for Infant Mental Health. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
Can you talk about some of the most essential things that a baby needs in order to develop normally in terms of mental health?
Well, I think having parents who care about them and who really want to pick them up and love them and look in their faces and have the baby look back at them. When the baby goes, ooh, they go, ooh, back. And the baby smiles and they smile back. Babies like that are ready for anything.
Some of that sounds like instinct, but I have to imagine that there's so much science devoted to this that it doesn't come so easily to some parents?
I think it takes giving parents a chance to see themselves as important to their babies and how important it is to the baby for them to pay attention back to the baby.
If you think about part of what Dr. Brazelton is saying as something you might call emotional availability, and then you begin to think about all of the things that make it hard for a parent of a very small child to simply quiet themselves and be present and take in what's going on in the moment, what their baby who can't speak with words yet has to say without words, then I think you begin to see how for many of us, there are all kinds of challenges, whether it's the cell phone that's about to ring or the BlackBerry that's dinging or the many, many pressures on us to attend to all kinds of other things that make it hard to just push those aside and tune in. And then for parents who are struggling perhaps with a history over generations of not having been able to be able to care for their children because of experiences of oppression that have interfered. Memories of one's own childhood come back at the time of a baby being born, and those can also make it a lot harder than maybe it sounds at first.
Let's talk about that, because I know that you both believe it's critical for parents to sort of sit down with themselves and understand, good and bad, what took place with them in their childhoods in terms of making decisions for how they will parent their own kids and just understanding their particular behaviors and the things that sort of spring to mind. What should people look for?
I think they should face their own issues, face their own background, their own cultural issues, and come to terms with them so they can pay attention to the baby's behavior. And I think parents need to understand that the behavior of the baby is the way he's trying to communicate. Everything the baby does is saying something special to those parents.
There's also the idea, a lot of parents strive to treat all of their children exactly the same. All siblings sort of have the same standard. Is that a reasonable goal? Is it possible when they come sort of pre-wired into the world to have the exact same conditions for every baby?
No, it's not. Babies are different right from the first, and babies shape their parents' behavior more than their parents realize and more than the parents shape theirs.
And there's something else that I think we often don't think about in our very individually focused culture, where we may see each child as this project that we're moving towards a particular set of goals, which is that when you have more than one child, you have a family, and you have the relationships between each child among the children. And so you're not raising each child separately, but you're raising a family where these relationships are ongoing and really take on a life of themselves. So part of your job as a parent isn't even about individually raising each child, but it's about facilitating those relationships between the siblings.
There's even a piece of work showing that maybe children's relationships with each other is more important than their relationship with their parents.
Yeah, I read something recently about the fact that if you want to really predict how well your child would deal with conflict later in life, you should look at relationships that they have with siblings and with their best friends.
That's right.
We are talking this hour about infant mental health with Dr. Joshua Sparrow and Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. I want to talk about this concept of infant mental health because people hear this and they, you know, if they really don't understand what it's all about, they think to themselves, well, how can you tell if an infant is mentally healthy?
Yes, it is in some ways an unfortunate term because it conjures up a pre-verbal infant in diapers on a couch 4 times a week in psychoanalysis, which doesn't really make any sense. And one important thing about the term is the word infant, which is to say that the foundations for mental health actually begin at the very beginning of life. And in fact, they begin before that in utero. We can talk more about that if you like. And then another important word in there is health, which is that it is not about necessarily treating mental problems once they arise, but about promoting health preventively in advance.
How important, you mentioned in utero, you know, old wives' tales would say that if the mother was very stressed out during pregnancy, then her child would have all kinds of problems. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, it turns out that there have been a lot of studies looking at this issue. And if women are depressed or anxious or, as it turns out, report feeling angry or have experienced really major stresses, and some of the studies have looked at women who've lived through natural disasters, they have elevated levels of cortisol, the stress hormone. And in some of the studies, they found that the newborns have elevated levels of cortisol at birth as well. And those increases correlate with very specific changes in newborn behavior. Using Dr. Brazelton's neonatal behavioral assessment scale, they are less able to regulate themselves. They're more irritable. They're more difficult to console. They have a harder time settling into an alert state to be able to focus. And now there's a whole body of literature that has shown, moving all the way out to adolescence, that there's an increased risk of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, learning disabilities, and other behavioral problems. So it's really quite clear that major stress, and I think women should be reassured that we're not talking about low levels of stress necessarily, but major levels of stress do influence fetal brain development. And I think we know enough now to know that paid maternity leave and enough of it so that you could take some of it in the last trimester would really pay off for the whole family.
Well, I've collected 12 stresses that parents are under today that are more than they were when I was raising my children. And these 12 are terribly important for us to understand so we can give parents the support they need to make it with their children and to give their children the best future they can.
One source of stress for some parents is the idea that they have to go back to work and leave their children
That's right.
in care of other people. What do they need? What do parents need to look for when they're choosing a daycare provider?
Well, I think they're looking for somebody that cares about the child and who pays attention to everything the child says and everything the child does. And I think they ought to be looking for somebody who pays attention to them too. So if they get that, a person who can do both, they've really got it made.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I don't know what the care is like inside, but there's a lot of centers where literally it's a sort of a drive-through situation, and parents have almost no contact with the providers.
It's no good.
Yeah. Dads are taking a much greater role in day-to-day interactions with their children. I have to imagine this is a good thing. What's the difference between the way a mother and a father approaches a baby?
Do you want to tell your story?
Well, if I hold a newborn baby up with its head in my left hand and its bottom in my right hand, and talk to him and say, "Hi, how are you doing? Hi." You can turn to my voice. Any newborn stops moving and turns to my voice. And if I get the mother over here and we compete and we both talk to the baby, any newborn worth its salt turns to the mother's voice. At that point, she grabs her baby and says, "Oh, you know me already. Aren't you great?" And she starts rocking and rocking and rocking, and they communicate back and forth in this beautiful rhythm. If I get a father over there and get these macho types to play with me, the father comes up, and we both talk, and 80% of babies choose their father's voice instead of mine. And if they don't, I tip their head. And at that point, every father grabs his baby and says, "You know me already." And he starts bouncing the baby up and down, up and down. And fathers have more poking and more jerky behavior with their babies. Mothers have quieter, gentler, sort of rhythmic behavior.
So that just 8 weeks later, in your studies, when you have the mother walk into the room and you're measuring the baby's respiratory rate and heart rate and blood pressure, as soon as the baby sees the mother and the eight-week-old baby, everything about the baby settles down and quiets and the baby's muscle tone relaxes because the baby already has memorized that the experience will be this soothing, calming kind of envelope around the baby. When the father walks into the room, the eight-week-old's heart rate, blood pressure, respiratory rate, everything gets excited and starts going faster because they've already learned that it's going to be all about poking and being physical. And the baby's muscle tone goes up and they get this this expectant look on their face like, we're going to have fun, but it's going to be more rough and tumble. And so clearly the kind of learning that's available to children who are lucky enough to have two different parents with two very different approaches makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the conclusion of this is that babies really benefit from having both when it's possible.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
They do. And a baby really looks for that second input. If they don't have a father, they look for a male who can replace that father.
I've been really astounded and delighted to watch my parents with my kids. And I have to tell you, they're not the same people they were when they were raising me, but they're incredible. What do grandparents and sort of older extended family members bring to a child's life?
Terribly important. I think children who have grandparents are very lucky.
And is there a special sort of job that we can look to grandparents to provide?
Well, you know, in many cultures, when you say the word family, you are talking about the grandparents and maybe also the aunts and uncles. And in fact, in some cultures, it would be offensive to imply that the word family did not include the grandparents. So it's, I think, a very recent and culturally specific notion that the family is the nuclear family. So with what I guess in our mainstream culture we call an extended family, there are different roles, but those roles are defined differently depending on the culture. You know, there's some cultures where it is the grandmother mm-hmm. who really is the decision maker and the authority and the guide as to much of the child rearing practices.
I think grandparents hand on the values of the culture and the things that come from one generation to another.
Let me have you pause right there. We need to take a quick break. We're speaking this hour with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow about infant mental health. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Dr. Joshua Sparrow, who is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, Professor Emeritus at Harvard. They worked together on the two most recent editions of Touchpoints, Birth to Three, and Touchpoints, Three to Six. They're in town for the Texas Association for Infant Mental Health Conference this weekend. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You write in Touchpoints Birth to Three that aside from love, the most important thing that you can give to your children is discipline, which I think is an interesting statement that maybe bears some talking about. What's the difference between discipline and punishment?
Discipline is paying attention to the child's issues and not just saying, this is the way you do it. You watch the child and the child tells you, I need you to step in and tell me when to stop. And if you do it, then you got it.
I think you always say that the difference between discipline and punishment is that discipline is teaching.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to simply reprimanding.
Right.
Which is not to say they won't make the same mistakes multiple times.
Well, that will happen with punishment as well. I think another difference is that punishment runs the risk of teaching a child how to avoid getting caught.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Steve in Denton. Hi, Steve.
Hello, folks. I had a quick question. As far as your research that you're doing on the 0 through 3 age range, have you done any research with any foster/abused type children at all?
Sure. We do a lot of it, and we know now what times a child is liable to be abused. We can tell you there are four times in the first 2 years when abuse is likely to happen, and if we can predict those four times, couldn't we prevent it? I don't think abuse ought to happen. I think it ought to be prevented.
What are the four times?
The first is colic, which is usually starts at around 3 weeks of age, peaks at 8 weeks, and usually levels off, ends around 12 weeks of age. And there's an increased risk for abuse then. If you just think about it for a moment, you have an infant who cries for about 3 hours at the end of at least 3 days a week.
I know it well.
the crying does not respond to all of your efforts to console and really makes you feel kind of hopeless. If you add on to that other risk factors like postpartum depression, which makes mothers feel as if they're no good as mothers and that their babies aren't responsive to their care, then the risk does go up. The second one is the 9-month touch point. And at 9 months, there's a lot of things going on. One, of course, is that babies are suddenly more mobile, so that you've got to do all kinds of containing and controlling and supervising because they're scooting and cruising and crawling now, and they can get trouble, they get hurt. And it's a lot more work. It's a different kind of work. And parents also have to face the kind of new independence and autonomy that a crawler has, that it's really different from a baby who can just rock in your arms. And then the other thing that happens at 9 months is they can put their finger and their thumb together and pick up little bits of food and throw it at you and at the floor. And so you see more force feeding then, because this is the age when infants want to take over feeding. And if you struggle with them over it, you will lose. And then the other thing that happens at 9 months is that infants have really learn to put together their ability to look at the human face and to distinguish very specifically what different facial expressions are saying. And the way that plays out for parents is they're crawling towards, because they can crawl now, towards the electric socket with their finger pointing to it because they can point now. And then they look back at you and they look at your face and you say, no, don't go there. And then they keep on going, and then they look back at you again. And what they're really specifically doing is looking at your face to look at what it means, and they've discovered this power that they have over you. You're like their marionette, and they can pull the strings and make your eyebrows go up and the corners of your mouth pull out. And so that makes parents feel like they're being jerked around or manipulated or played with, and that's another reason why that's a heightened risk of abuse. And then the two others are, of course, temper tantrums, mm-hmm. and then finally toilet training is another time where there's a big peak in abuse.
What do you ask parents when they come in and they've got a baby? How do you sort of check their, relatively speaking, their mental health in terms of their capacity to raise their children sensibly and with love and with some self-control?
Well, I watch them and watch to see how they interact with their baby. And if they pay attention to the baby and can pick up the baby's cues, I already know they're on the baby's wavelength. And then I ask them a few questions about their own past mental history. And if they can tell me how they've managed their own issues, I know they're on track.
It's really about listening to the music more than the words. And if you do listen to the words, I think the thing to listen to is how closely a parent's image of who their baby is fits with the baby that they've really got. And when there's a really big discrepancy, then there are likely to be problems.
I want to go back for a minute to Steve's question about foster children and abused children. Mm-hmm. We know so much now about the critical importance of the first 3 years that I wonder if a lot of people don't worry that if a child has had less than ideal circumstances during that time, that somehow they are permanently damaged and beyond hope of being fully normal as they continue to develop.
Well, I don't. I think we ought to be, there are two things we ought to do for foster parents before we allow them to take over a child. One is that we have to tell them, you know, the child is not permanently damaged. They can make up for it if they work appropriately. The second is that I think we ought to be sure they understand the individuality of that baby and they understand the baby's behavior. And then I think we ought to, a third thing maybe, is we ought to get them to tell us about their own mental health.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Going back to the question that we had earlier about choosing daycare, it came up in the break that people should also look at turnover rates at daycare centers.
Right. And I think part of our learning just how much is going on in the infant brain in the first years of life, just how dramatic the development is. We've also learned that babies differentiate individuals very, very early, as could be told from the story Dr. Brazelton told about infants with mothers and fathers. And so I think we used to think that in the first couple of years it was okay to have interchangeable caregivers. And now we know that that just isn't true and that it's terribly confusing and distressing for infants. And so one of the things to look for in quality care is to look for caregivers who stay. In any center who's got caregivers coming and going is not going to be able to provide the kind of care that any baby deserves. And unfortunately, because that profession is so undervalued in this country and so poorly paid, of course people do have to come and go, because if there's a job that pays better, it would make sense for them to go after that.
I think it's great that you call the book Touchpoints and not Milestones. There are so many books out there that tell you your baby should be doing this at this moment and ought to have moved on to that. And people can get really sort of hung up on what they read somewhere. Are you often in the habit of reassuring parents that their kids are okay, or do you have to sort of point out to them that, in fact, there might be a problem that they haven't noticed? Which is more likely to happen?
Well, I think parents already know they have a problem if they have one. Mm-hmm. And so I just listen. I ask them, what's on your mind today? And if they tell me they have an issue and they want to discuss it, then we discuss it. If they don't, I watch to see how they interact with their baby. And if the baby is out of control, then we talk about it.
I think one of the differences between the concept of touch points in development and milestones is that touch points is really about a dynamic process through which development happens. Mm-hmm. And basically what it says is that whenever an infant or a child is on the verge of taking an exciting new developmental step, there will be a price to pay for it that will show up as some kind of falling apart or disorganization in a previously acquired skill or area of functioning. And so that often when parents are concerned because things look like they're going backwards, it may turn out, if it lasts briefly, that was the cost of the exciting new step. So we see this particularly right before a child is learning to walk. Almost systematically, parents will find that their babies have a whole lot harder time sleeping in those couple of weeks before they take their first step. So it's really more about this dynamic process through which development happens than just about the specific chronological moment when it should happen. And part of the process is that when the baby becomes disorganized in the service of development, guess who else becomes disorganized? The whole family and the child care providers, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Greg in Richardson. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I have a question based on some baby books we read. How can you comment on the value or benefits of establishing routines for very small babies?
I think it's great, and I think it's hard to do. I think you wait at first until the baby begins to fall into routines, and then you reinforce them, because at first you need to pay attention to the baby's needs and be open to
on-demand feeding?
Yeah, demand feeding.
Yeah.
And then as the baby gradually at about 2 to 3 weeks begins to fall into a routine, then you pick it up and you reinforce it, and then you find that routine works. And routines are terribly important to children.
So there is this old debate that I sort of hope is past us now, but there was a time when really very early on, babies were put on strict feeding schedules.
Ferberizing, is that what they call it?
No, way before Ferber. Mm-hmm. No, but the idea was that babies were supposed to be on a schedule and you were supposed to feed them at a certain time. And I think what that failed to recognize was that the baby's experience of being hungry and not being responded to was that he or she was in a world that wasn't going to be able to take care of him. Mm-hmm. And so that at the very beginning of life, when baby schedules are thrown completely out of whack by the natural trauma of birth, on-demand feeding is a way of giving very young babies the sense that where you are is a really good place to be, because no matter what, we're here to listen to what's going on with you and to take care of you. And you can't expect very young infants to do without that. And I think what Dr. Brazelton is saying is that over time, when they begin to pick up on the very concrete cues of daytime and nighttime, they gradually can be worked into more of a rhythm. And then by 4 months of age, their brain development has evolved sufficiently that they should be able to begin to put together a couple of sleep cycles to sleep through the night. So when you talk about routine, it depends what age you're talking about and what kinds of routines you're talking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Andy in Arlington. Hello, Andy.
Hi. I just wanted to say, Dr. Brazelton, I love you. I think you've been a wonderful parenting guide for me with my children, and I really appreciate it. But say you have a child who is learning different or learning disabled, whatever. And so the reading kind of touch point is a hard one to reach. And so they get locked in sort of an aggressive, angry state. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I think children with special needs are particularly hard. And I think you have to recognize that a child with special needs has two touch points, not just the one that everybody expects them to have, but one that they really have. And so if you can see that they're going to have two, then you can pay attention to each and reinforce them at the appropriate time for when they need it themselves.
I would suggest that you consult with the Niehaus Center, N-E-U-H-A-U-S, in Houston, which specializes in reading learning differences, because part of the answer is really getting the best advice you can on what the nature of the problem is, because there's a lot of really great help out. And all of the other things that we can do really need to be put together with help that's going to make a difference for the child. But then certainly there is, I think, taking some of the steps that Dr. Brazelton would suggest to support the child's self-esteem and to appreciate all of the other things that he or she can value about himself or herself, independent of the challenges faced in the area of reading.
Is it possible to overparent even an infant?
To overparent?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
What do we need to let them do for themselves?
I think when you overparent a child, you take away the initiative and you don't give them a chance to realize I can do it myself. And so you're really interfering with their self-esteem, their ability to feel I can do it myself.
So an example with a young infant might be that overparenting can interfere with an infant learning how to soothe herself. And so it doesn't mean that you walk out of the room and don't come back for 15 minutes, but you might stay in the room and stay close and watch if you have an infant who's crying and see whether or not she's able to begin to settle herself down, maybe to get her thumb into her mouth, maybe to clutch the edge of the soft little blanket and bring it up to her cheek to soothe herself and to begin to breathe a little bit more slowly. And if instead she just escalates and gets red in the face, then she's telling you, I need your help right now. And she will learn from your help. So it's not that there's always one way, but I think overparenting would interfere with that moment of observation where you're figuring out, does she need me to help out here, or can I watch her and see how much of this she can work on her own?
We're talking about the touch points of infant mental health with Dr. Joshua Sparrow and Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. They're in town for the Texas Association for Infant Mental Health Conference this weekend. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Dr. Joshua Sparrow and Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. They are co-authors of the books Touchpoints, Birth to Three, and Touchpoints, 3 to 6. They're in town for the Texas Association for Infant Mental Health Conference this weekend. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. An email from Meg asks, I've heard about birth bonding, the idea that as soon as the baby is born, he should be put skin to skin with mom rather than whisked off by the nurse to get eye drops and shots, as is often done in the hospital. Can you comment?
I think that's right. I think a mother ought to have a chance to bond with their baby before all that happens. And I don't know why we don't pay attention to that.
On the other hand, there is kind of a tyranny of this theory, which many mothers experience. If they didn't get a chance to do that, they worry that they've missed this one-time opportunity forever and that things will go wrong as a result. And I think it's also true that you get more chances. So I agree with Dr. Brazelton, but I think we need to be careful not to build this up into something that makes people feel like they've done it all wrong if they haven't done that. You had a story about how they give birth on a Greek island that pertains to this. You remember the mother who was giving birth and on this Greek island, and She had cans and sticks and stones, and she'd throw them at her husband who was cowering in the corner.
Right.
And then your wife actually was there, and she went over to him and said, "Oh, are you okay? Are you okay?" And he said, "No, no, this is my job." and then so she would, every time she would groan with a labor pain, she would throw something at him. And then when she finally gave birth, they brought the baby over to her, and she turned away and put her hand up as if to say, "No," and you were really worried at that time. You thought, "Oh my goodness, maybe there's some problem with the bonding here." And 30 minutes later, the mother turned back and signaled, "Bring my baby to me. I'm ready now." And all she was saying was, "I needed a little break before I could do this."
I take it this was birth without an epidural.
Yeah.
I need time for myself to recover.
What about that? A lot of new parents feel really guilty about ever being away from their babies. Can you offer some guidance as to how much is enough and how much is too much and what people should think about?
Well, you know, Dr. Brazelton was very involved in advocating for the Family Medical Leave Act, which got us the 3 months of unpaid parental leave, which is the shortest parental leave of all 27 industrialized wealthy democracies and also the only one which is unpaid. But we got that through Dr. Brazelton's advocacy. And the time frame he actually was pushing for 4 months was based on how much infants and parents are learning from each other about themselves, about each other, and about how to communicate with each other, and how much goes on in those first months. So I think part of the answer to that question is there. And maybe another part of it is that for most of human history, in most cultures, humans actually have shared the care of their children with multiple caregivers. And I think it's a fairly recent and probably short-lived phenomenon that we have this sense that all of the care must be provided just by one or two individuals. And so there might be some reassurance in knowing that humans have really done quite well all along in spreading the care along, as long as those other relationships can also be ongoing and consistent.
Well, I think also a parent knows when they understand their baby and when the baby understands them. So at that point, they're ready to make a separation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Pat in Arlington. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. Yeah, I've noticed that toddlers and crawlers, sometimes if they fall, they kind of pause. They don't necessarily cry right away, but if a parent or caregiver comes over as though it's a crisis, an emergency, then they'll start to cry. But if someone comes over and, like, they want to play and tickles them or something, then they'll laugh and play and, like, the fall never happens. So I'm curious what's going on. Why is the baby doing that, kind of learning how to react? Or maybe a real injury or not a real injury, I don't know.
Well, that's a great question, and you're a great observer. That's called social referencing. And it's what I was talking about that really comes into place at 9 months of age. And so what's going on is the baby is looking at the parent or caregiver's facial expression and reading it very specifically to figure out, what's going on here? Am I okay or am I in danger? And based on what the facial expression says, the baby's behavior will pursue one direction or the other. And so parents, especially the second or third time around, learn to really manage their reactions and the information they give without words through their faces, because they know babies that age are already very capable of reading them. So it's not that they're manipulating you or faking you out. They're really trying to figure out, how bad was that I just fell down? And the person who's going to know is maybe not me, but it's going to be my mommy or my daddy. And if I look at their face, I can tell by the configuration of their eyebrows and their mouth and the wrinkles on their nose, I can figure out whether or not I'm going to be okay or if this is something I should be really upset about.
And I'm guessing there's no danger of missing a real injury. If they're truly in pain, they're going to cry.
That's right.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Flower Mound and speak with Jason. Hey, Jason.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had I wanted to ask a couple of, one question, actually, and get some comments on it. I just wanted to know what you might have found as far as the pros and cons of different types of custody arrangements. currently, my son's mother and myself do split custody every other day, where I've heard of a lot of couples nowadays doing 1 week on, 1 week off. So I just wanted to hear a couple comments as far as what you have found in your research.
Thanks for your call.
So custody arrangements, the timing, 1 day at a time, 1 week at a time. And it depends partly on the age of the child, because very young infants will have a harder time holding on to the memory of the other parent. So that's one issue in making the determination is the child developmentally able to hold on to the memory and the presence of the other parent when they're not physically present? And then another issue is how well the child is able to handle the changes from one setting to another, how disorganizing it is. Now, Dr. Brazelton's solution for this has always been to have the parents change households
and
to have the child stay in the
yeah.
same house.
Yeah.
And that would take care of some of the challenge to the child of adapting to the different mm-hmm. environments, although you still have to adapt to the different parenting styles.
And it sounds like you really have to read your individual baby or young child to see how well they're coping. Some
That's
may
right.
be okay and some can't handle it.
Uh-huh. That's the most important thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Do you think that if a child has been through an event that by all accounts is to a certain extent traumatic, a divorce or a parent being very ill or something, should we assume that that child is going to need professional help to get by, or should we wait for signs that there really is some trauma taking place?
Well, I'd wait. I'd see if you can manage for yourself and help the child understand it, help the child figure out what to do about it, and see whether the child has resources that will get through it by himself. But I think the main thing that you're asking about is, should the parent pay attention to this? Should they share it with the child? And the answer is yes, always.
I think there are also a number of protective factors or resiliency factors. And if a number of those are in place, it's more likely that the child will be able to heal and recover and get through this without professional help. So I think part of the answer to your question is to look at some of those protective factors. So the kinds of traumas that affect not only the child, but perhaps really interfere with the resources of the whole family to continue to communicate with each other and hold each other's feelings, those might be the kind where you might want additional help, just because a protective factor is the ongoing relationships with other sources of close family members for support.
Well, I think if parents can manage their own issues around a problem like that, then they know the child is likely to be able to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We go next to Faye in Dallas. Hello, Faye.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I suspect this question is about bonding, mother-daughter bonding, but I don't know. I've been watching a single parent in my neighborhood interact with her 18-month-old daughter, and the little girl hits her. She doesn't hit other people. She's very sweet, in fact, and cooperative, but she clearly prefers men. To women, and she does hit mommy. And I'm wondering what could account for that. She's 18 months old.
Well, she needs a male figure, and she's looking for one. And the fact that she looks for one and finds, you know, she'll find it.
I would speculate, and it's only a speculation at this great remove, that if the 18-month-old is hitting the mother, it's because the mother on some level is tolerating it. And if she's tolerating it, it may be that it's because she doesn't know effective ways of conveying to her daughter that that's wrong and she shouldn't do it and it's not acceptable. And sometimes you see that on some level a mother feels as if she expects it or deserves it, and that interferes with her being able to stand up to it. You see this often in mothers who have experienced domestic violence on the part of the fathers of their children, that they end up being somewhat confused about aggressive behavior on the part of their children. It can make it hard for them to really be able to take a firm stance to teach the child to get their aggressive behavior under control.
What do you suggest people do when they see a child who is not in imminent danger, not being abused, but a parent and a child who seem to be having a hard time relating to one another or sort of getting by in the ways? It's difficult for everybody, but if something stands out, so many people don't want to interfere, but there could be a child's well-being at risk.
Well, you have this great story about that time you went to the grocery store and you saw this 2-year-old who was pulling everything off the shelf.
Yeah.
And then you want to tell that story? And the mother started hitting him?
Well, I remembered our something that we've learned, that instead of jumping right in and telling a parent what she ought to do, we ought to listen to her and find out what she can do. So instead of going over and holding her arms because she was whamming away at this 2-year-old for pulling off these things off the shelf, I went over and I said, "Oh, isn't it hard to go to the grocery store with a 2-year-old? They always pull things off the shelf." And she looked at me and she sat down and she started weeping and weeping. And at that point, this 2-year-old went over and rubbed her tears away. And she said, "Thank you." And so I found out that a positive approach is what you really need to do to give parents what they need.
Yeah, start with some empathy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think the moral of the story is that when we see a child in distress, we, of course, want to rescue the child, but it's hard for us to recognize that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, the way that that's going to happen is by being able to help a parent get their bearings again, and that we do that best not by judging or criticizing, but by connecting with a parent through empathy and strengthening them to be able to respond in a way that's more effective with their child. I know there are exceptions to that. I've worked with those exceptions, mm-hmm. But they are exceptions.
The last thing I want to ask you about, we've talked about choosing a caregiver and having other family members involved. What do you recommend to parents as they're choosing a pediatrician? Because sometimes it's just you have to fit with this person. Do you understand what I'm saying? What do you look for when you're interviewing a doctor?
Well, I would look for somebody who cares about parents as well as children, not just children, but also parents. And I'd look for a pediatrician that pays attention to parents and takes everything they ask seriously and sets up some rules for parents about when they call him and when they don't, and sets up a sort of expectation between them. And then if he's responsive to them, I would feel good about him.
Dr. T. Barry Brazelton has been my guest this hour, along with Dr. Joshua Sparrow. They are co-authors of the two most recent editions of Touchpoints, Birth to Three, and Touchpoints 3 to 6. They are in town this weekend for the Texas Association for Infant Mental Health Conference. Gentlemen, it's been wonderful. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.